Okay, I was looking to see if I could show you Pike's Peak out there, but even with no leaves, the trees are in front of it, so be it. I could walk out into the street. You can see it clearly from there. Anyway, today we are talking about the chapter in this book that is a science of religion and a religion of science. And this is a very cool chapter because this is the one that makes very clear the reasoning, the logic that supports science of mind and the belief and spiritual mind treatment. So here we go. This is going to be a history lesson. Ernest Holmes was born in 1887, according to the preface of this book. And, well, no, not the preface. That's just information. But he published this book in 1957. That's in the preface of this book. It's not just the publication date that's actually on the book. That may not be all that important to a lot of people. Anyway, he was born in 1987. Family was Baptist. But his mother, apparently, was all about the goodness of God and wasn't going to hear anything about this hell and damnation stuff. They just were not going to do that in this family. And so he grew up with the notion of the goodness of God. And he just grew from there. There was nothing that said, no, that's a bad thought. Stop thinking that. So he just was thinking. And what was this God all about? And what are we doing here? And who are we? Et cetera, et cetera. And he was reading other people. He finally ran across Thomas Troward, who in 1909 had published a book that said that we must properly understand our relation to the great impersonal power. It is intelligent, and we are intelligent, and these intelligences cooperate. We can't fly in the face of the law by expecting it to do for us what it can only do through us. And we have to use our intelligence with the law, with the knowledge that it is acting as our intelligence is acting as the instrument of a greater intelligence. We must first form the ideal conception of our object with the definite intention of impressing it upon the universal mind. Does that sound familiar from anybody that has learned about religious science and spiritual mind practice? That was published in 1909. He also had done a lot of reading and talking to Mary Baker Eddy about Christian Science, but there were things that just didn't jive with everything he, you know, there were foundational things that he agreed with, but there were other things he didn't agree with. He was also reading Emerson from back in the day. And so he grew up with this notion of no dualism. There was a single thing and that from Emerson, that this universalization gives us the divine participation, because if it's all one, then we are participating in whatever all this is. And there is this essence of this divine in us. There's a presence. And so he learned about positive prayer and also the notion that if anybody can pray effectively, everybody can. And so that's pretty cool. So here comes the notion from Troward that there is only one mind because you can't have two different infinites. So there can only be one mind in the universe, and we can work within it. We can use it. So anyway, eventually he started speaking publicly. He then started attracting people to him because he also ran across Emma Curtis Hopkins eventually and was learning about the mystical aspects of actually supporting people and using this mind in terms of healing and working with people that way. And he started to a private practice doing this kind of thing and kept talking and doing public presentations. And then he started writing, published The Science of Mind. The first edition of it was 1922. He was 35 years old. And then this book here that we're talking about came, 35 years later. So this guy has been on a roll. So in The Science of Religion and a Religion of Science, he starts out, and I'm going to walk you through the chapter, starts out with definitions of science and religion, and also philosophy, and that philosophy is about opinions. Science is about natural law. Religion is about what we believe is going on in the universe and our lives. And so we have science, and then we have scientific principles, that there is materialism, so, and then there is idealism. And these are philosophies and ways of looking at the world. And both of them all agree that the universe is one of intelligence. And this matters because we're just thinking through, well, what is all this and how do we fit in it? And that's what's happening here. People who are scientific-minded people thinking through, well, how does all this work? And how does religion fit in? And a materialistic way of looking at scientific principles would say there is no consciousness, that there is integrity, there is an order in the universe, and the universe has to make sense, but there's no consciousness. I got a feedback from somewhere.
You need to mute.
Also, that this universe, whatever, does not respond to humankind. Now, and I don't know if you watched The Big Bang Theory, but this is Sheldon. Atheists might fit in this category, and yet you can't say it. A lot of atheists are as spiritually evolved as anybody else. It's just different. But it's still with integrity and order and honor and respect and things make sense to them. The other way of thinking about things is this idealism. And this is the one where there is a consciousness in the universe, that something is behind this, that even the little atoms and things, they seem to have volition, and they have a will of their own. And so in the universe, there is this notion that there's something going on here kind of on purpose. There is a volition here. There's not just the engine of how it all works, but there's also an engineer. And this way of thinking says there's something here, a force, a power, you know, force be with you, that responds to humans. And in that case, we can participate in this. But since we're talking about a scientific way of approaching religion, you can't have superstition going on. You can't just, woo, not that. There has to be an order. There is a law to what's going on, and there is an order in this universe. And that means, you know, if it's being impersonal, it has to be, because if it's a law for everybody, not just, oh, not you. It's a law for everybody. It's going to be the same thing for everybody. So nobody is more, you know, favored or esteemed than anybody else. Well, you can see where certain kinds of, you know, people that many religions might think, well, this person is it. This way of thinking would say, well, this person is it, and so are you, and you, and you, and you, and you, and you, all y'all are it. I love that. I can't remember. Oh, I know who it was. It was a journalist in Texas that said, all y'all is the most powerful, inclusive category of any. All y'all. Yeah, that's inclusivity for you. Anyway, so there's no preference over anybody. Everybody's in this together. Everybody's got the same capability foundationally, depending on what got piled on them during their lifetime. But also this means, though, if you can't have superstitions and you can't have, you know, magic, you know, any technology that's sufficiently advanced looks like magic. Was that Buckminster Fuller or somebody? You can't do that. It all has to make sense. It has to have a reason for it. And that means also that that while humankind can participate in this divine, whatever it is, power, energy, way of being, it doesn't mean that humans can change the laws of nature. The laws of nature and the principles of nature, the principles of science are in place, but it means that we can get in alignment with them and flow with them. Not that we can say, oh, no, you got to go over here. No, I can't do that. You get in alignment with it. and then you can participate. And so also these way of being, you cannot, the religions cannot contradict reason. That just doesn't make sense. Now, maybe there needs to be more knowledge that happens to help one understand why this makes sense. But once it makes sense, it makes sense. You can't say, well, that, no, that's not real. You can't do that. And you have, there's common sense involved here and law. Just, this is the way things work. Gravity's gravity. Can't say, oh, no, we're not going to do that anymore. Our religion doesn't believe in that. Okay, I can't do that. Anyway, because everybody has their own different way of looking at things and thinking and acting, everybody's got an opinion about, especially me, have an opinion about everything, and everybody's entitled to my opinion. What they do with it is different. But so religions come. There's lots and lots of religions, lots and lots of philosophies, ways and explanations for how things are. And a lot of religions can be very entertaining when they start dealing with their various superstitions and what they believe. And if a religion's working for the participants, cool beans, it goes on. If it doesn't work, then that religion disappears because it's not working and nobody wants to go. So scientific religion, this is straight out of the book, can only be based on the principles of mind, of intelligence, and consciousness, and therefore ultimate and fundamental reality. And this includes individuals' consciousness. And that means you have a communion with this consciousness. Connie writes about the beloved. There you go. You got a communion with it. You're arriving with it. Now, this is not about a petitionary relationship. If you've got a communion with it, you've got a prayer process, an interactive process with it. And that's part of what Holmes got into with Emma Curtis Hopkins and the mystical aspects of it. Well, now we have, yes, there is the law of the universe and the way things work, but it starts to get different. There's something else there, and the mysticism starts to flow, and that gets real interesting. But anyway, so we are of this power. Therefore, we can participate, and therefore, we can call this communion and interaction prayer if you want to. But it's an interaction. It's a communion with. And so now I'm getting farther into this chapter, and Holmes' words himself are so powerful. I'll just read to you for a while. We might speak of pure religious science as a branch of that branch of science which studies natural principles, the nature of mind and consciousness. Then we would think of applied religious science as the application of this principle to human needs for practical purposes. And this is where we encounter the study of prayer, of faith, of mental actions and reactions. In the use of faith, prayer, communion, or spiritual mind treatment, we apply the principles of mind, spirit, intelligence, consciousness, and law and order to the problems of everyday life. Now we have more than just theory. Now we have an applied and practical application within religion. Ho ho. Now, he goes on to say that all religions pray to the same God. Yes, on a real meta level, if there is only one, then there's only one. But I would suggest that the God that various different people in various religions are praying to, their concept of God, is not the concept of God necessarily that we hold. And I think it's, sometimes people get all touchy-feely and idealistic and say, it's all the same God. We're all playing the same. No, no. Different religions have their own concept of God. And so some of them have way different concepts of God from ours. You know, some of them, that concept of God was documented thousands of years ago, and that's it. And the concept of God that says it's all the same thing, it's all one. We got a God creating out of its own self, of itself, and we're of it, and that's a way different God. And so our concept of God is a different sort of concept of God. And some of the religions have a flavor of that. And I don't know that it's the same thing. So anyways, we go along here. And when do I have to stop, Connie? Can't hear you. You're muted.
On the hour.
On the hour. Okay, cool beans. Ooh. Okay, well, do we have permission to extend another 45 minutes past that? Okay, here we go. To the individual believing there is a principle, intelligence, or consciousness governing all things, there comes a feeling that he or she understands the laws, or at least some of the laws of this principle. Hence, the person feels that it is intensely sane, as well as humanly practical, to apply faith, consciousness, and spiritual conviction to the solution of human issues. This is what is meant by spiritual mind treatment. Ooh. Spiritual mind treatment is based on the belief or the theory, which we now feel has a sound basis, that there is a principle of intelligence in the universe which is not only creative and gives rise to objective form to stuff, things, everything, but is also immediately responsive to our consciousness. We are in connection, in interaction, in communion with this consciousness. And being universal, it is omnipresent. And being omnipresent, it is not only where we are, but it is what we are. And if there is an infinite creative intelligence which makes things out of itself by becoming the things that it makes, and if we exist and are conscious, then the creative genius of this universal mind is also the creative genius of its individualization, which we call humankind. And so as we participate in this, as we engage in this communion, as we aspects of individualization go through our lives and realize there's something going on here that we would like to have different, we can bring this into our own mind, be real clear on what it is we would like to have be going on, how we want this to be, what we would like different, if we need to, whatever it is, remembering that we are in communion with this power. We are in connection. We are in relationship with this creative force that is everything and creates out of its own self and has consciousness. And we are within that consciousness. We're an individualized aspect of it. We are an individualized representation of it. We're part of it. We get to play. We get to play in the creative process. And if we hold it, and if we get that feeling, and if we sink into it, yes, you can do it that fast. Of course you can. And we could spend a little more time in it. We could soak in it. We could call this prayer. We could call this, here's what's going on. And here's what I'd kind of like to have be different. And here's what I really believe about how this could be different. Ooh, and I can see that about whatever it is, me or whatever the situation is related to me that I'd like to have be different. Here's what I like it to look like. Here's what I'd like to feel. I can step into that image. I can step into that way. I can step into that realization and be it in consciousness. The other thing that's important here, this is really important. Where is it? Where'd it go? It's on the left side page. I thought I had it marked. There we go. One may logically hold the belief, the opinion, or the certainty that God as us, in us, is us. And that when we make a proclamation, it is still God making that proclamation. But, at the level of our consciousness. So the consciousness of God is consciousness of God. But the consciousness in play as we participate as an individual expression or representation of this consciousness depends on our own consciousness. If we are, at the level of these great spiritual teachers, that's one thing. And if we're at the level of, I don't think this is going to work. Yo, God, you at least don't start with, I don't think this is going to work. You got to have some level of understanding. And see, that's why this chapter is so powerful, because it makes it clear that, we are of this same consciousness. We get to play in this. It's legitimate. It's valid. It's supported by reasoning and principles of nature. And so when you enter into working within this power, within this creative process, you do want to start with some notion that, this is real. This works. If you got any doubt involved, or if you've got any, skepticism, why include it? It's your mind. You have free will, at least for something like this. And so why not just choose to act as if, act within the belief that whatever doubts or skepticism or anything else that I may have, I'm way better off engaging in this by putting all that stuff aside and just go for it, because it ain't going to hurt you. And you don't want to be like a surgeon that gets into doing a surgical process and has so much doubt they say, I don't know, so I think I'll just do this a little bit. Well, I do not want that guy or that woman. No, thank you. I want the one that knows. Yeah. All right, here we go, folks. I got a team here. We'll see what happens next. Room. And know that one way or the other is going to work out. And whatever thoughts we may have about might not, that doesn't belong in this process. This is a powerful, affirmative, creative process. So why on earth stray out of that? Get in that powerful, creative process and be there. Go for it. Use whatever consciousness you've got applied to that. And as Holmes teaches elsewhere, we are open at the top. We're willing to learn. We're willing to expand. We're willing to just, go for it. We don't even know where this goes, but we're willing to play. We're willing to go. And so that is very cool beans. And now I want to add a cautionary tale. It's called Social Media. I recently watched something, a documentary and a bunch of interviews of the people who created social media. One guy said, we had 25 young white men in the United States who created something that was going to have an impact on 2 billion people. We had no idea. We did not know where this could go. Never occurred to us. And so now social media could be in competition for your consciousness, big time. Because these computers with their algorithms are figuring out ways to know that collecting data, if you're using these systems, they're collecting data about who you are, what you like, what you watch, and how long you watch it. And then they sell your attention span. They sell, and so they get you to click on things. Click this, as long as you're looking at stuff That's time you're engaged with your screens. You are, you know, they're selling that attention, and then they put ads in there. And they're making trillions of dollars by buying your consciousness, or at least what you're doing with it. And so I think it's an important thing to remember that these people, they have meetings on persuasion. They have powerful psychological studies and research on persuasion and how to get humans to act in certain ways. In our little brains, we don't know how to defend ourselves except don't participate or be very careful with your participation. What are you doing with your consciousness? What are you doing with your fine mind? Now, if you're meditating, they say, what are you doing with your fine mind? What's your mind up to right now? Oh, right, back here. Well, with some things, if you are engaged, you don't even know what you're doing with your mind unless you back up and go, whoa, what am I doing? Click, 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 click. And so I just offer a cautionary tale that this stuff is really, really powerful. And some of these engineers and programmers are saying they do not allow their children to have phones until they're in high school. And they delete all their apps and all their notifications. And these are the people who create it. People that were saying that I was appalled by what was my creation was doing to my children. And that's it, stopped. So I think that, you know, yes, this stuff is powerful and it's a force for good. And be aware of, you know, here's the good we like, and here's all the other stuff that is beyond our awareness, maybe, except that we know it's there. And so, yeah, I think I'll just do this, and that's that. So, yes, what are you doing with your fine mind? What are you doing with your consciousness? And are you truly participating and allowing your consciousness to grow, to expand, to enhance your life to the extent that it can and would? If. That's a big if. Well, part of it is, okay, don't let these programmers and computers run it and allow my will, my preferences, my volition participate in this amazing creative process that is our life. And so I'm at my time.